Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, J.P. DeGance on supporting healthy marriages for stronger faith.
There's a lot of evidence, first off, from the data that couples that pray together stay together, and they are happier. So in that 10-minute check-in, starting with appreciation and then asking our spouse, what can I pray for you? You know, closing that time, 10 minutes together, that you invite to prayer together. I think it's a great habit for us to develop a prayer life. I think it's important for us to have a life of prayer individually on our own. It's important for us to have a prayer life as a family, okay, when we have children, but it's also actually super important for us to develop a prayer life together.
J.P. DeGance next. Co-authors John Van Epp and J.P. DeGance believe the decline of marriage and family stability in the United States is closely connected to declining religious faith and church participation. In their book, Endgame, The Church's Strategic Move to Save Faith and Family in America, they contend broken family structures weaken people's openness to Christianity, especially among younger generations. Spencer Dahlke is with J.P. DeGance.
As we kind of like look at your work with Communio, I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about the story behind the organization. For some reason, I get the impression you just kind of popped up out of nowhere, but I don't want to, I just assume that's true.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's right. The origin story, I came to Washington, D.C. like a lot of young people who come here idealistically trying to save the world by focusing on politics. And my parents loved the Lord and inspired me on the life issue. I came to D.C. motivated on that issue, got involved in conservative policy more broadly, and just began to realize that a lot of what we're working on in the public policy world is really dealing with the downstream effects of the crisis affecting the American soul, which is the collapse of faith, which is driven by the collapse of marriage. And in my own life, God made this clear to me. I had a close family member whose marriage failed in an abusive way, and she had four kids, and asked my wife and I to take in her four kids. And we did that. They were 10, 11, 14, and 15. And we had three of our own at the time, three under three. And we just experienced in a powerful way what happens when marriage fails. And over the coming years, I just started asking the question of what would it look like to take what I had learned in the public policy world, in the private sector, to baptize the strategies and technologies, to baptize them and sanctify them, bring them into the service of the church. And, you know, one of my big points to pastors is that there's no gospel mandate to be unsophisticated, right? So we try to bring the very best, use our entire heart, mind, soul, and strength to support and equip the local church to share the gospel, draw new people in, and then bring really good evidence-based strategies that can affect change on marriage health, get more people married in healthy Christian marriages. We started, though, Spencer, I think it's worth noting, we had a big pilot that was our first foray into this, and worked in Jacksonville, Florida, worked with my good friend Richard Albertson and his ministry, Live the Life, and we mobilized 93 local churches in Duval County, help them saturate the digital environment there with ads drawing people in to the local church. We had a number of different partners there and moved 58,912 through 4 hours or more relationship skills in a county of about 900,000 people at the time. And the net was the divorce rate dropped 24% in 3 years. Churches grew. Those that baselined their attendance grew by 23%. And at the end of 2018, we said, you know, how do we scale this? And from 2019 to 2021, we were thinking through the business processes to scale it. We thought the unit of scale was the city, but we started to realize it was really the local church. And we repivoted to really focus there. We're now active in 32 states. We've worked with more than 440 churches and growing. We have big statewide initiatives with regional church networks now in Texas with the Texas Baptists, in Arizona with the Arizona Mission Network, with great family policy councils and their church ambassador networks in Pennsylvania, where we're pulling in great evangelical church bodies, and in Ohio with the Center for Christian Virtue in Pennsylvania. It's with the Pennsylvania Family Institute. So some really great, the Lord is opening up some big doors around the country for us as we continue to grow.
Something you mentioned that I thought was really interesting is that marriage is upstream from faith, that with the collapse of marriage, we see the collapse of faith. Tell us about where you come to that idea. Yeah.
So there's a phenomenal book that helped me get going in this direction, How the West Really Lost God by Mary Eberstadt. And it got me down a journey to try to unpack this, right? I'm persuaded by Mary's argument that faith and family are a double helix, right? They mutually support and reinforce each other. There's a big term that you might use called bilateral causality. And that just means that it goes back and forth. However, what's not debatable is that since 1960 in the United States and in the West, I would include Western Europe going back a few decades prior, one came unglued in that double helix before the other. That was marriage. The marriage began in 1960, the sexual revolution at a retail level hits. The decoupling happens between sex and marriage, where you have artificial contraception goes retail, you have no-fault divorce, you have abortion beginning to grow, all these things where it's decoupled. And then you have marriage decoupled from sex, from parenting, and then ultimately from partnering. So you have a rapid growth in the 1960s of non-marital households and individuals raised in single-parent homes. It's not until another 25 years until pollsters start to see religious non-affiliation start to grow. And so it's our case that it's the fruit of this sexual revolution that starts to show up in non-affiliation data. And reinforcing that, we published a study called the Nationwide Study on Faith and Relationships. Any of your listeners can download it from our website for free. Now, we've now surveyed over 200,000 people sitting in church on Sunday through our partners. And 80% of everybody in church grew up in an intact married family. And that includes those in the youngest age groups. If you're born in 1965 and you're a married man and you're in church on Sunday every week, 81% of your peers in that age group grew up in an intact married family. But it probably would surprise a lot of your listeners to know that if you're born in the year 2000 and you're a single guy sitting in church on Sunday, 81% of his peers are also grew up in an intact married family. What that means is that what changed over the last six decades is the average family we grow up in. And so there's a lot less people showing up in church from younger age cohorts because there's a lot less of them who grew up in an intact married home. So our key here is to press into the local churches to understand marriage significantly drives outcomes as it relates to faith. And we should think about Christian marriage. It is the original small group. It's part of God's plan for humanity. It was a gift for all of humanity that points back to his salvific plan, right? You see, we obviously know and see it in Genesis at the beginning, and we see it at the end of time in the eschatological wedding feast of the Lamb. And then we see that nuptial theme throughout the scriptures in the Old Testament, continuously pointing at God's love for his bride, the church, in a spousal way, from the Songs of Solomon, from the minor prophets to the major prophets, you know, from Hosea to Isaiah. And you see it, obviously, in the New Testament, in the sacrificial love of Christ for his church, and laid out and described as that great mystery in Ephesians 5, right? As spousal love, right? So one of our messages to the local church is that when marriage health declines, it shouldn't be a surprise that faith in Christ declines, because ultimately we experience the love of an earthly father in a married home. And when we don't experience the love of an earthly father, it's harder for us to grasp that there's a father in heaven who so loves us, right? That he gave his only son to die for us.
I was going to suggest maybe it's because we don't have an image for our children to see who God is like if our marriages aren't strong.
100%. And we have brand new, a new research partnership that we have. We're not a think tank. We support the local church in ministry. We're coaches. We provide technology support. But a big part of we see our mission is to help educate the church to this great need in this 21st century moment to drive revival, and cooperating with the Holy Spirit and producing revival. The data keeps pointing back to the biblical evidence that marriage is central to that. And we've got a new research brief that'll be coming out with our partner, the Institute for Family Studies, and unpacking how the family, our family of origin, is the single biggest factor that affects future faith outcomes. And then unpacking what that means in the research, right? And some of those are, look, growing up in an intact married family matters a lot. And then as an adult, can you look back in your childhood and say, did you have a good or warm relationship with your mom, a good and warm relationship with your dad? And then did you go to church regularly with them? And then did you have open conversations that encouraged your Christian faith? Those four norms dramatically increase the likelihood of someone growing up to choose to follow Jesus and have faith in him. So if the church becomes a hub for healthy relationships and healthy marriage, I truly believe, you know, one generation of Christian marriage well lived will transform and change the world.
Just for the sake of like pushing back a little bit, I don't disagree, but I can't also help but think, like, you know, Paul talks about, I wish people were like me and single so that we could focus on the kingdom of God. So
yes,
where does that factor into the discussion?
It's elsewhere described as our Lord, you know, Jesus calls, you know, eunuchs for the kingdom. The reality is, and we use this in our coaching with churches, right? Marriage is the most common path to grow in holiness. It's not the only one. Paul is maybe the best example of the single Christian. But we have to ask ourselves, what is the nature of Paul's singleness? It's a singleness for the kingdom. And it is a life of chosen chastity, chosen celibacy, right? Certainly, that's a great gift for the kingdom, for those who devote their lives to service for the kingdom. But that's a rare path. And in the most common path is the married path to image Christ's love for the church. Paul, even in his singleness, in his chosen life, I would argue biblically, he's pointing to the heavenly Jerusalem, right? His singleness is pointing to the wedding feast to the Lamb. And so even in that, it's foregoing it for the future marriage, right? So in either case, okay, marriage is key.
So I guess looking at our culture, you mentioned, obviously, we got the sexual revolution, a culture of promiscuity undermines marriage. What other threats to our marriages do we see in our society today?
I mean, there's a lot. They're legion. And so as a consequence, and it's been systematic, the attack and assault on marriage has been systematic. We didn't get into this place because the evil one created a one-time six-week out-of-the-box kit to destroy the family and ran it once a year. Okay. And so we're not going to get out of this with our own 6 week, once a year kit. We coach churches on the idea of also having a comprehensive approach, a comprehensive strategy to push back. But just let's hit on a few. Pornography, it used to be kept to the bad part of town in seedy stores, and you'd have to go out and purchase it. But now our devices that we have in our hand has it a couple clicks away from anybody. And in many ways, that the digital revolution of 2012 with the smartphone has led to the proliferation even before that, but then since that, the proliferation of pornography. So how are we equipping our young people on this? This includes young women. The terrifying thing, there's a great book for anybody interested in diving into this data more called Cheap Sex, The Transformation of Men, Marriage, and Monogamy, written by Dr. Mark Regnerus. And it's a mix of both quantitative and qualitative data. And he notes that young women between the age of 16 and 20 about have the same pornography consumption habits of men around the age of 50. So it's still lower than young than men and boys in that age group, but very high rates of pornography consumption, even with young women. And so this is changing all sorts of things. It's making it harder and harder for our young people to have a healthy sexual life and marriage. It's much harder for men and women to relate to each other. It's changing the number of boys and men who have asked a girl out in person on a date is now, you know, a majority have not in young men's circles. And so as a consequence of all this and many other things, right, you could also, obviously, you could point out legal challenges. This is not intended to be a systematic explanation of every challenge facing marriage, but obviously there's legitimate concerns around family law that causes some men to be hesitant to enter into marriage. There's, and you've got the big message of cornerstone versus capstone on marriage, right? So this is a change of narratives that has come from the world that many Christian parents have actually absorbed and shared with their kids. It's this idea that you should prioritize, get your education, get your career going, and get financially stable, then get serious about relationships. This is a very brand new message. We're talking about it becoming common around the year 2000. And that message is common in the church. I was asked to speak to a group of mostly Christian Ivy League students earlier this year. And I asked all of them, these are conservative Christian, mostly Christian Ivy League students around the March for Life. And I asked them, how many of you have heard from your parents that now's not the time to be in a relationship. Now's the time to get buckle down, focus on your studies, get your advanced degree, maybe go get your career going, and then, you know, look around and get maybe, you know, start to get serious about marriage and relationships. About 70% of that room raised their hands. You know, this is a problem for folks inside the church. However, when we share those kinds of messages, we're increasing the likelihood for every year marriage is delayed in a population, the number of people who never marry goes up proportionately. So it's not just that people are waiting. It's that when they start to look, there aren't, they can't find those folks. You know, it's important for parents to let their sons and daughters know, don't squander your 20s, be intentional about your relationships. You know, 22 to 26 is a perfectly reasonable age, statistically speaking, and historically normative age to consider marriage. And then learning the skills of having a healthy, what a healthy spouse looks like, what a healthy marriage looks like, is really something that we can teach our young people, equip them with, so it's not scary and they don't have to, they can dramatically reduce the likelihood of making a bad decision of who to partner up with in marriage.
Well, my guest today is J.P. DeGance. He's author of Endgame, The Church's Strategic Move to Save Faith and Family in America, and, of course, founder and president of Communio. It's interesting you brought up family law. I didn't realize that that was an issue. Would you give us kind of like, I'm just interested, give us a little look into that.
Yeah, it's I think there's legitimate concerns within family law that, one, family law, the family law system is in many ways set up in a demonic way where the attorneys are monetized around conflict, right? The more conflict, less healing, less resolution, the more both legal parties earn from their clients, right? And so about 70% of divorces are initiated by the wife. Does not mean that 70% of the divorces are caused by the wife, that the proceeding is initiated by the wife. And family law tends to, in many jurisdictions, an individual that initiates can oftentimes, in a sense, legally remove the kids from the other spouse, file for divorce, and then the other partner needs to wait until a hearing to resolve custody. Custody is often not resolved in a 50-50 way. And I point out in this regard as evidence, in the state of Kentucky, they did a major legal reform of just in a no-fault filing, there is the court has a bias towards 50% time custodialship in a divorce. And that one change, you know, the year after it, it was followed by a 24% decline in the number of divorce filings in Kentucky. So there is certainly some legal impediments that are hurting the family. And you know, we've gotten to the place in our country where it's oftentimes quicker to get out of a marriage than what used to be a cable contract that you used to have with your cable provider, right? So that ought not to be the case. So certainly I think legitimate concerns there. And I generally push back on folks who want to blame one or the other genders on the crisis in marriage. I think that's a mistake. I think there are problems that come from men that are hurting marriage, but I also think there are problems that come from women that are hurting marriage. The reality is God made us complementary toward each other. There's things that we each need and lack. And so beating up on one or the other disproportionately, I don't think is helpful. I think there's legitimate differences and problems in modern culture affecting men. And problems affecting women. We should be honest about those. We should help protect our young people from those and help facilitate a healthier relationship between the sexes that can lead to better rates of marriage.
Oh man, don't even get me started. The wars that, like, even on social media that you see between men blaming women 100%. For, you know, and women blaming men. And oh man.
That's what the enemy wants, right? Ultimately, you know, there's literally something biologically lacking in my physiology that my wife has to bring about new humans, right? We need God biologically. We need each other. And so the evil one would love to create an adversarial relationship between us. And sometimes I think, because I think, you know, obviously pastors are by and large men. And so it's easier to be, I think, self-deprecating or to focus on the challenges from our side of the street. I think sometimes the problem within the church is the criticism of the situation where we are in marriage does focus on a sort of self-criticism, which is good as part of the Christian life, but does focus heavily on the challenges facing men, I think, in most churches. And so it can lead to a lack of balance in how we talk about the challenges facing our young people on marriage, because there's certainly increasing, as an example, a major, I think there's polling has showed a major radicalization of young women, where increasingly more extreme liberal views are driving a divide, where young women who hold very liberal views are even saying that they wouldn't date somebody who holds a different set of political views. And that is driving some significant decline in the number of people coupling up and marrying as well, and ought to be talked about in a healthy way.
How can men take the lead in actually bringing healing and life and be good gardeners?
Yeah. Let me share a couple data points that will reinforce the need to do this, right? In the church, about 1 in 5 report saying that they're struggling right now in their marriage. This is of people in church on Sunday morning, but there's not an equal reporting on that. So women are 62% more likely to say that they are struggling in their marriage than their husband. The peak gap, Spencer, between young men and young women, or men and women in marriage, is married church-going women in their 30s with married church-going men in their 30s, okay? That gap is 109%, meaning church-going married women in their 30s are 109% more likely to say they're dissatisfied than their husbands. Now, some happy news, because still, the majority in every decile group, church-going married people, say that they're very happy in their marriage, but there's a large minority within each age group that are unhappy. And so knowing that women, our wife is more on average, more likely to be dissatisfied, men appear from our data to be less likely to engage in marriage ministry. And there's lots of reasons for it. Sort of like, hey, we're fine. Everything's great. You know, I don't understand why anything's wrong. This is how we might be able to lead, as a, for instance, a very concrete way. So as a husband, maybe we should, well, not maybe, we ought to initiate activity that will help us grow in health and holiness. That's a key part of our role in the home. And so it might be once a year, we should be prioritizing getting to a marriage class, a marriage retreat, not because there's anything wrong. It should be normal that we spend the time to invest in our marriage. On this side of the eschaton, we're all works in progress. None of us have maxed out the possible holiness that we can grow in. And that includes our own marriage. So if we've got a great marriage, then we should work on it. We value it. Going to, you know, finding a marriage class, something like Navigating Us, Re-Engage, the Marriage Course by Alpha. There's some great stuff out there. I would say initiate as simple as a 10-minute, once a day, conversation. Set aside devices. Get away from the TV. Get away from the computer. Kids are in bed. Spend 10 minutes face to face and have a conversation, not about the budget, not about the errands that need to be run. Initiate that conversation with a simple, what am I appreciative for in my spouse, right? We know in the Christian walk, right? Gratitude is a big part, continuously grateful to God for all that we have. Well, we should be bringing that spirituality into our relationship with our spouse. You know, instead of first thinking about how unhappy I am that he left his socks on the floor, or we didn't get the dishes into the dishwasher, or some area of frustration, we start with, what are the maybe two things or three things or one thing today that I'm really grateful for in my spouse, or that she did or he did. So initiating, you know, taking the lead on initiating that kind of conversation is a great way that a husband can be a leader in the home, a leader in the marriage, by initiating that and being able to work on the skills of setting expectations in a healthy way, right? Oftentimes in marriage, the big problem is that the two parties didn't have the same expectations, and they didn't have a healthy way to share and communicate on those expectations. And it leads to frustration and then conflict. And then that conflict isn't resolved in a healthy way. And it's usually not because either one of them is a villain or a bad guy. It's oftentimes, you know, 70-80% of divorces are considered low conflict, where there isn't adultery, there isn't substance abuse, there isn't something really irreparable. Okay. And in those situations, those couples oftentimes just need some good coaching to develop and practice the skills. And so I think husbands initiating and taking the lead and not saying no when their wife asks to do something like a class on marriage. I think these are some good steps. I generally discourage from, you know, most couples who are struggling, most, not all. The best first step is not counseling. Okay. In counseling, that person is kind of like your Yoda, the person who's going to help you solve your problems and guide you. Okay. Most people don't need a Yoda. They need an athletic trainer, somebody who can give some basic coaching and guidance on running and passing or lifting or exercising, but using this analogously for relationships and coaching on the skills of communication, coaching on the skills of conflict resolution, because when people have those skills and they learn them, they usually solve their own problems. Okay. But oftentimes people don't have the skills to do that. And oftentimes we don't grow up in a home where their healthy conflict resolution is modeled and shown when we're kids. That oftentimes can be lacking in people's lives. So those are just some thoughts on how I think husbands can be proactive as leaders on their marriage.
And certainly different than what we're told. So it's like, yeah, it's nice to, and you have data.
Look, Claire, and by the way, Spencer, I didn't say, which is oftentimes from my vantage point is should be implied, but I want to state part of that is also inviting our spouse to prayer. There's a lot of evidence, first off, from the data that couples that pray together stay together, and they are happier. So in that 10-minute check-in, starting with appreciation, and then asking our spouse, what can I pray for you? You know, closing that time, 10 minutes together, that you invite to prayer together. I think it's a great habit for us to develop a prayer life. I think it's important for us to have a life of prayer individually on our own. It's important for us to have a prayer life as a family, okay, when we have children. But it's also actually super important for us to develop a prayer life together, okay, what that looks like. So obviously, and a husband can invite our spouse to prayer. It could be simple. It could be just even a minute together in prayer, and taking that step is a great step toward authentic Christian leadership in the home.
How can our church be good support structures for our families?
You know, the core of the family is the marriage. And oftentimes churches are scared to lean into helping people in their marriage, because we also know that there's a lot of woundedness and trauma and brokenness. And we fear holding up marriage because of the folks in the pews that may have had a bad experience with marriage. Okay. So first and foremost, understand that that's not of God. That's the enemy. Okay. We should not be fearful to help one talk about marriage and to help people live out marriage well. There's a way to acknowledge wounds and trauma and challenges from our past. And anybody who's experienced such trauma and wounds would agree that we don't want to pass on trauma and wounds to others. And so this is why we want to lean in to help people live healthy marriages, discern marriage well. And in that sense, everyone in the church can be welcomed into relationship ministry. We got to make it normal, knowing that men are less likely to engage. So you want to make it fun and actually appeal to men so that men want to engage, because women are more likely to engage in this form of ministry. You want to make it relevant, okay, so that that's something when you walk away, you learn something that you can take and apply right away. Nobody became great at golf because they watched the Masters. It might be fun to watch the Masters, but you don't become great at golf because you watch the Masters. You have to go out to the driving range and maybe have a coach to help you learn how to swing and hit the ball. Marriage is similar. You don't learn because you watched a sitcom or you watched a healthy marriage on a TV show, or you heard someone lecture or preach on a healthy marriage. That's important. But we have to actually practice the skills, human and spiritual, that helps us to grow in health and holiness in our marriages. And our local church should be a place where people learn the skills and be encouraged, where this is just a place everyone works on their marriage, including the lead pastor, the executive pastor, the leadership team. This isn't something weird for, you know, the small minority of people who are struggling in their marriage. This is a full church. On this side of heaven, we're all a work in progress. If we've got a good marriage, we want to make it great. If we've got a great marriage, we want to make it better. And normalizing that is kind of the most critical thing for the local church to do.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to our guest, J.P. DeGance, co-author along with John Van Epp of Endgame, the Church's Strategic Move to Save Faith and Family in America. Thanks for listening, and I hope you can join us again on Monday at the same time for another edition of His People.